God has led out men who have toiled for years, who have been willing to make any sacrifice, who have suffered privation and endured trials to bring the truth before the world, and by their consistent course remove the reproach that fanatics have brought upon the cause of God. They have met opposition in every form. They have toiled night and day in searching the evidences of our faith that they might bring out the truth in its clearness, in a connected form that it might withstand all opposition. Incessant labor and mental trials in connection with this great work have worn down more than one constitution and prematurely sprinkled heads with gray hairs. They have not worn out in vain. God has marked their earnest, tearful, agonizing prayers that they might have light and truth, and that the truth might shine in its clearness to others. He has marked their self-sacrificing efforts, and He will reward them as their works have been. On the other hand, those who have not toiled to bring out these precious truths have come up and received some points, like the Sabbath truth, which are all prepared to their hand, and then all the gratitude they manifest for that which cost them nothing, but others so much, is to rise up like Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and reproach those upon whom God has laid the burden of His work. They would say, "Ye take too much upon you, seeing all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them." They are strangers to gratitude. They possess a strong spirit which will not yield to reason and which will lead them on to their own destruction. God has blessed His people who have moved forward, following His opening providence. He has brought out a people from every class upon the great platform of truth. Infidels have been convinced that God was with His people and have humbled their hearts to obey the truth. The work of God moves steadily on. Yet, notwithstanding all the evidences that God has been leading the body, there are and will continue to be those who profess the Sabbath, who will move independent of the body and believe and act as they choose. Their views are confused. Their scattered state is a standing testimony that God is not with them. By the world, the Sabbath and their errors are placed upon a level and thrown away together. God is angry with those who pursue a course to make the world hate them. If a Christian is hated because of his good works and for following Christ, he will have a reward. But if he is hated because he does not take a course to be loved, hated because of his uncultivated manners and because he makes the truth a matter of quarrel with his neighbors, and takes a course to make the Sabbath as annoying as possible to them, he is a stumbling block to sinners, a reproach to the sacred truth, and unless he repents, it were better for him that a millstone were hung about his neck and he were cast into the sea. No occasion should be given to unbelievers to reproach our faith. We are considered odd and singular, and should not take a course to lead unbelievers to think us more so than our faith requires us to be. Some who believe the truth may think that it would be more healthful for the sisters to adopt the American costume. Yet, if that mode of dress would cripple our influence among unbelievers so that we could not so readily gain access to them, we should by no means adopt it, though we suffered much in consequence. But some are deceived in thinking there is so much benefit to be received from this costume. While it may prove a benefit to some, it is an injury to others. Here we are referred back to the appendix, which says on this subject of dress reform, "The dresses generally worn by women in America at this time that this was written, 1863-1867, were very deleterious to health. They were especially objectionable because of their extreme length, the constriction of the waist by the corset, and the weight of the heavy skirts which were suspended from the hips. About a decade earlier, a few women of national prominence initiated a movement to adopt a new style of dress that would be free from these serious objections. The new mode of dress was somewhat like the Turkish costume worn by men and women alike. The movement became so popular that for a time, dress reform conventions were held annually. The American costume, here referred to by Mrs. White, was a modification of the earlier style and was sponsored by Dr. Harriet Austin of Dansville, New York. It combined the short skirt, reaching about halfway from the hip to the knee, with mannish-looking trousers, coat, and vest. There will be more on this later under the title Reform in Dress. This so-called reform dress was in 1864 shown to Mrs. White to be unsuitable for adoption by God's people. In 1865, Mrs. White, through How to Live, No. 6, appealed to our sisters to adopt a style of dress which was both modest and healthful. The next year, the newly opened Health Reform Institute in Battle Creek took steps to design a pattern of dress that would correct the extremes of the short American costume or the ultra-long heavy dresses as commonly worn. In 1867, Testimony No. 11 appeared with its first article, Reform in Dress, coming up shortly. In this, the dress question was fully reviewed and further counsel given. A general pattern was recommended as embodying the principles revealed to Mrs. White and was referred to as worthy of the name of the reform short dress. No particular pattern was revealed to her in vision, and when discussing the matter at a later date, Mrs. White stated, "Some have supposed that the very pattern given was the pattern that all were to adopt. This is not so. But something as simple as this would be the best that we could adopt under the circumstances. No one precise style has been given me as the exact rule to guide all in their dress." Signed, E. G. White, Letter 19, 1897. Quoted in The Story of Our Health Message, page 145. As the years passed, the prevailing styles of women's dress changed for the better, becoming more sensible and healthful. The old health reform dress in its exact pattern was no longer urged, but there was ever a uniform testimony borne by Mrs. White regarding the fundamental principles that should guide the Christian in this matter. Thus, in 1897, she wrote, "Let our sisters dress plainly, as many do, having the dress of good material, durable, modest, appropriate for this age, and let not the dress question fill the mind." Quoted from page 146 from The Story of Our Health Message. Now back to our main text. I saw that God's order has been reversed, and his special directions disregarded by those who adopt the American costume. I was referred to Deuteronomy 22, verse 5. "The woman shall not wear that which pertaineth unto a man, neither shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all that do so are abomination unto the Lord thy God." God would not have his people adopt the so-called reform dress. It is immodest apparel, wholly unfitted for the modest, humble followers of Christ. There is an increasing tendency to have women in their dress and appearance as near like the other sex as possible, and to fashion their dress very much like that of men. But God pronounces it abomination. 1 Timothy 2:9 says, "In like manner also that women adorn themselves in modest apparel with shamefacedness and sobriety." Those who feel called out to join the movement in favor of women's rights and the so-called dress reform might as well sever all connection with the third angel's message. The spirit which attends the one cannot be in harmony with the other. The scriptures are plain upon the relations and rights of men and women. Spiritualists have, to quite an extent, adopted this singular mode of dress. Seventh-day Adventists who believe in the restoration of the gifts are often branded as spiritualists. Let them adopt this costume and their influence is dead. The people would place them on a level with spiritualists and would refuse to listen to them. With the so-called dress reform, there goes a spirit of levity and boldness just in keeping with the dress. Modesty and reserve seem to depart from many as they adopt that style of dress. I was shown that God would have us take a course consistent and explainable. Let the sisters adopt the American costume, and they would destroy their own influence and that of their husbands. They would become a byword and a derision. Our Savior says, "Ye are the light of the world. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven." There is a great work for us to do in the world, and God would not have us take a course to lessen or destroy our influence with the world.
Chapter 4, The Prayer of David.
I was shown David entreating the Lord not to forsake him when he should be old, and what it was that called forth his earnest prayer. He saw that most of the aged around him were unhappy, and that unhappy traits of character increased especially with age. If persons were naturally close and covetous, they were most disagreeably so in their old age. If they were jealous, fretful, and impatient, they were especially so when aged. David was distressed as he saw that kings and nobles who seemed to have the fear of God before them while in the strength of manhood became jealous of their best friends and relatives when aged. They were in continual fear that it was selfish motives which led their friends to manifest an interest for them. They would listen to the hints and the deceptive advice of strangers in regard to those in whom they should confide. Their unrestrained jealousy sometimes burned into a flame because all did not agree with their failing judgment. Their covetousness was dreadful. They often thought that their own children and relatives were wishing them to die in order to take their place and possess their wealth and receive the homage which had been bestowed upon them. And some were so controlled by their jealous, covetous feelings as to destroy their own children. David marked that although the lives of some, while in the strength of manhood, had been righteous, as old age came upon them, they seemed to lose their self-control. Satan stepped in and guided their minds, making them restless and dissatisfied. He saw that many of the aged seemed forsaken of God and exposed themselves to the ridicule and reproaches of his enemies. David was deeply moved. He was distressed as he looked forward to the time when he should be aged. He feared that God would leave him and that he would be as unhappy as other aged persons whose course he had noticed and would be left to the reproach of the enemies of the Lord. With this burden upon him, he earnestly prays, "Cast me not off in the time of old age. Forsake me not when my strength faileth. O God, thou hast taught me from my youth, and hitherto have I declared thy wondrous works. Now also, when I am old and gray-headed, O God, forsake me not, until I have showed thy strength unto this generation, and thy power to everyone that is to come." Psalm 71:9, 17, and 18. David felt the necessity of guarding against the evils which attend old age. It is frequently the case that aged persons are unwilling to realize and acknowledge that their mental strength is failing. They shorten their days by taking care which belongs to their children. Satan often plays upon their imagination and leads them to feel a continual anxiety in regard to their money. It is their idol, and they hoard it with miserly care. They will sometimes deprive themselves of many of the comforts of life and labor beyond their strength rather than use the means which they have. In this way, they place themselves in continual want, through fear that sometime in the future they shall want. All these fears originate with Satan. He excites the organs which lead to slavish fears and jealousies, which corrupt nobleness of soul and destroy elevated thoughts and feelings. Such persons are insane upon the subject of money. If they would take the position which God would have them, their last days might be their best and happiest. Those who have children in whose honesty and judicious management they have reason to confide should let their children make them happy. Unless they do this, Satan will take advantage of their lack of mental strength and will manage for them. They should lay aside anxiety and burdens and occupy their time as happily as they can and be ripening up for heaven.
Chapter 5. Extremes in Dress.
We do not think it in accordance with our faith to dress in the American costume, to wear hoops, or to go to an extreme in wearing long dresses which sweep the sidewalks and streets. If women would wear their dresses so as to clear the filth of the streets an inch or two, their dresses would be modest, and they could be kept clean much more easily, and would wear longer. Such a dress would be in accordance with our faith. I have received several letters from sisters inquiring my opinion in regard to wearing corded skirts. These questions were answered in a letter which I sent to a sister in Wisconsin. I will give the letter here for the benefit of others. We, as a people, do not believe it is our duty to go out of the world, to be out of the fashion. If we have a neat, plain, modest, and comfortable plan of dress, and worldlings choose to dress as we do, shall we change this mode of dress in order to be different from the world? No, we should not be odd or singular in our dress for the sake of differing from the world, lest they despise us for so doing. Christians are the light of the world, the salt of the earth. Their dress should be neat and modest, their conversation chaste and heavenly, and their deportment blameless. How shall we dress? If any wore heavy quilts before the introduction of hoops, merely for show and not for comfort, they sinned against themselves by injuring their health, which it is their duty to preserve. If any wear them now merely to look like hoops, they commit sin, for they are seeking to imitate a fashion which is disgraceful. Corded skirts were worn before hoops were introduced. I have worn a light corded skirt since I was 14 years of age, not for show, but for comfort and decency. Because hoops were introduced, I did not lay off my corded skirt for them. Shall I now throw it aside because of the fashion of hoops that is introduced? No, that would be carrying the matter to an extreme. I should ever bear in mind that I must be an example, and therefore must not run into this or that fashion, but pursue an even and independent course, and not be driven to extremes in regard to dress. To throw off my corded skirt that was always modest and comfortable, and put on a thin cotton skirt and thus appear ridiculous in the other extreme, would be wrong, for then I would not set a right example, but would put an argument into the mouths of hoop wearers. To justify themselves for wearing hoops, they would point to me as one who does not wear them, and say that they would not disgrace themselves in that way. By going to such extremes, we would destroy all the influence which we might otherwise have had, and lead the wearers of hoops to justify their course. We must dress modestly, without the least regard to the hoop fashion. There is a medium position in these things. Oh, that we all might wisely find that position and keep it. In this solemn time, let us all search our own hearts, repent of our own sins, and humble ourselves before God. The work is between God and our own souls. It is an individual work, and all will have enough to do without criticizing the dress, actions, and motives of their brethren and sisters. Seek ye the Lord, all ye meek of the earth, which have wrought his judgment. Seek righteousness, seek meekness. It may be ye shall be hid in the day of the Lord's anger. Here is our work. It is not sinners who are here addressed, but all the meek of the earth, who have wrought his judgments or kept his commandments. There is work for everyone, and if all will obey, we shall see sweet union in the ranks of Sabbath keepers. Unquote.
Chapter 6. Communications to Elder Hall.
Here we have a footnote first saying, the General Conference Committee would here express their approval of the publication of this testimony. Especially do we recommend the publication of the letters addressed to Elder Hull and given to him at the time of their dates. We call the particular attention of the reader to the declaration on page 442, coming up shortly. It is there stated that Elder Hull needed to be led as a blind man who depends on another for sight. At the General Conference in Battle Creek, May 1863, Elder Hull acknowledged the justness of the statement, but has since protested against it. The committee now maintain that his course in the short space of the past 4 months, in abandoning every point of religious faith dear to us as a people, is a most palpable demonstration of the correctness of the above statement that he should follow the counsel of his brethren. Signed, the General Conference Committee. November 5, 1862, I was shown the condition of Brother Hull. He was in an alarming state. His lack of consecration and vital piety left him subject to Satan's suggestions. He has relied upon his own strength instead of the strong arm of the Lord, and that mighty arm has been partially removed. I was shown that the most alarming feature in the case of Brother Hull is that he is asleep to his danger. He feels no alarm, feels perfectly secure and at rest, while Satan and his angels are exulting over their conquest. Just as long as Brother Hull maintained a conflict, his mind was reined up and there was a collision of spirits. He has now ceased the conflict, and the collision ceases. His mind is at rest, and Satan lets him have peace. Oh, how dangerous was the position in which he was shown me! His case is nearly hopeless, because he makes no effort to resist Satan and extricate himself from his dreadful snare. Brother Hull has been dealt with faithfully. He has felt that he was too much restrained, that he could not act out his nature. While the power of the truth in all its force influenced him, he was comparatively safe. But break the force and power of truth upon the mind, and there is no restraint. The natural propensities take the lead, and there is no stopping place. He has become tired of the conflict, and has for some time wished that he could have more freely actions himself, and has felt hurt at the reproofs of his brethren. He was presented to me as standing upon the brink of an awful gulf, ready to leap. If he takes the leap, it will be final. His eternal destiny will be fixed. He is doing work and making decisions for eternity. The work of God is not dependent upon Brother Hull. If he leaves the ranks of those who bear the blood-stained banner of Prince Emmanuel and joins the company who bear the black banner, it will be his own loss, his own eternal destruction. I saw that those who wish can have plenty of room to doubt the inspiration and truth of God's word. God compels none to believe. They can choose to rely upon the evidences which he has been pleased to give, or doubt and perish. It is life or death with you, Brother Hull. Already I saw a cloud of evil angels surrounding you, and you at perfect ease among them. Satan has been telling you a pleasing story about an easier way than to be in constant warfare with conflicting spirits. But if you choose that way, you will find in the end that you will have a heavy and fearful toll to pay. I saw that you have felt strong in yourself, felt that you had arguments which could not be gainsaid, and you have not relied upon the strength of the Lord. You have too often rushed upon Satan's ground to meet an opponent. You have not waited until you knew that the truth or the cause of God demanded a discussion, but have engaged with opponents where with a little forethought you would have decided that the truth could not be advanced or the cause of God benefited. Precious time has thus been spent. Satan looks on and witnessed the heavy blow which Brother Hall dealt to spiritualism in Battle Creek. Spiritualists understood his organization and felt assured it would not be in vain to make a determined effort to overthrow him who injured their cause so much. In discussing with spiritualists, you have not merely to meet man and his arguments, but Satan and his angels. And never should one man be sent forth alone to combat with a spiritualist. If the cause of God really demands that we confront Satan and his host as represented by a spiritual medium, if enough is at stake to call for such a discussion, then several should go forth together that with prayer and faith the host of darkness may be driven back and the speaker shielded by angels that excel in strength. Brother Hull, you were shown me under the soothing influence of a fascination which will prove fatal unless the spell is broken. You have parleyed with Satan and reasoned with him and tarried upon forbidden ground and have exercised your mind in things which were too great for you, and by indulging in doubts and unbelief have attracted evil angels around you and driven from you the pure and holy angels of God. If you had steadfastly resisted Satan's suggestions and sought strength from God with a determined effort, you would have broken every fetter, driven back your spiritual foe, come closer to God, and triumphed in his name. I saw that it was presumption in you to go forth to meet a spiritualist, when you were yourself enshrouded and bewildered by clouds of unbelief. You went to battle with Satan and his host without an armor, and have been grievously wounded and are insensible to your wound. I greatly fear that the thunders and lightnings of Sinai would fail to move you. You are in Satan's easy chair and do not see your fearful condition and make an effort to escape. If you do not arouse and recover yourself from the snare of the devil, you must perish. The brethren and sisters would save you, but I saw that they could not. You have something to do. You have a desperate effort to make, or you are lost. I saw that those who are under the bewitching influence of spiritualism know it not. You have been charmed and mesmerized, yet you do not know it, and therefore do not make the least effort to come to the light.